Well, moving from the fishes that live on coral reefs to the animals that build them. It's all very well for fish to swim off and find each other to mate, but what about the marine animals that are stuck fast to the seabed? Barnacles have quite an impressive solution to this problem. They've evolved the longest penis relative to body size in the animal kingdom, but even well-endowed barnacles can only reach so far. Reef-building corals have evolved a different strategy for having sex whilst rooted to the spot, and the results can be quite spectacular. Someone who's witnessed coral reef sex is James Guest from the National University of Singapore.
It's a pretty spectacular event. Typically, you only see it at night time. And just before the spawning, nothing is really happening. It's very quiet, and there's no activity. And then suddenly, within a period of about half an hour, you'll start to see bundles of eggs and sperm. They're small bundles. They're a few millimeters across. They're often pink or red or orange. And they start to be released from many colonies at the same time and also often many species at the same time. And the effect is something like a sort of a snowstorm in reverse, upside down. So you can imagine at night time, with all these brightly colored bundles all being released, the effect is very spectacular. It's something like perhaps being in one of those snow globes, those little toys that children have.
So how many times in a year do we see the spawning?
Well, typically there is often one major event. So there's a kind of a peak in spawning activity. In some parts of the world, it is around springtime. However, there are other spawning events, and not all the corals go off at one time. Some individual species and some colonies will go off more than once in a year.
And how on earth do the corals manage to coordinate to make sure they all spawn at the same time?
It's still a bit of a mystery exactly how they do it, but basically it must be at two levels. So at one level, the corals must have some internal clocks that certainly run on a daily rhythm, so what we call circadian clocks, but they could also run on a lunar rhythm, so a circa-lunar clock. They may even run on an annual cycle, so a circa-annual clock. And we know quite a lot about circadian rhythms for a lot of other organisms, but we don't have much information about that for corals yet, although there is some research being done now. But then on another level, there's also the environmental cycles. So the internal clocks that the corals have must be sort of entrained by these environmental rhythms. So the environmental rhythms kind of keep the clocks in check.
And once they've all spawned and their eggs have been fertilised and started to develop, I suppose they face challenges like avoiding predation and finding a suitable surface to settle on. But what other potential difficulties do the coral larvae and the young polyps face?
On top of all the natural challenges that they face, there's the addition of the sort of human impacts that almost all coral reefs around the world now are feeling. Aside from climate change, many reefs are experiencing very high sediment levels because of land reclamation and coastal development and so on. So excess sediment sort of falling on top of a small coral polyp can very, very quickly smother it. Another problem is overfishing. So many reefs around the world have lost the big herbivorous fish, which do the job of cleaning a lot of the algae off the reef, the macroalgae, seaweeds and so on. And again, when coral spat have to sort of compete for space with algae, often the coral spat won't do as well, and so that's a big challenge for them. And then added on top of that, there's the bigger problem of climate change. There's not really much known about how climate change is affecting the coral reproduction. We know quite a lot about how it affects adult corals, and of course it's having a big effect because we're seeing lots of corals that are bleaching. That's when they lose their symbiotic algae, and if they don't recover them relatively quickly, they tend to die. That the few corals that are left, they're not going to have so many individuals that they can mate with. And so if you know, when we go back to what we talked about earlier about these mass spawning events, I suppose the critical thing for those mass spawning events to be successful is to have lots and lots of individuals all spawning at once. But if the sort of critical mass of corals has suddenly dropped drastically, as you can imagine, the chance of successful reproduction is going to be much, much lower.
Because of the overproduction of gametes by the corals to buffer against things like predation, we could use the mass spawning to seed or repair damaged reefs. So either moving the collected spawn to new places or taking them back to the lab to rear them and then releasing them out into the field. How would that work?
So there's a couple of ways that this could be done. One way is to sort of harvest mass spawn slicks, just take billions and billions of embryos, and exactly as you said, is just to pump them down onto a bit of reef, maybe within some sort of enclosure, and try to just massively boost the amount of recruitment. The other way is, again, as you say, we could rear them in the lab so that we try to sort of overcome all those, that mortality bottleneck that you experience in the sea, and then settle them in a tank on land, let the corals grow up to a size where they've got a good chance of surviving, and then place them back on the reef. So the first method, we've done some experiments with that, and although it works in the sense that we can boost recruitment, what we found is that if you look at 6 months or 1 year down the line, that the reefs that we have artificially seeded don't look any different from the reefs that have not had any seeding. So at the moment, that particular method doesn't look like it will be very successful. The other method of rearing the corals in the lab for a period of time potentially has some promise, and we've had a bit of success with that in designing some little substrates that are cheap and easy to make, and we can settle corals onto them, we can rear them, and then eventually we can plant them onto the reef. And we've had some success with the technique. The main problem with it is it's actually very expensive to do. So really, I mean, if you had that kind of money to spend, you'd think that it might be much better to spend it on management initiatives, on protecting an area, methods that we know are more likely to be effective, at least at this stage. I mean, I think we need to do more research on these restoration techniques, and it may be in the future that they can have some really good uses, and there's some pretty exciting stuff that can be done. I think whatever happens, restoration is never going to be the only solution. We have to manage reef ecosystems effectively from the point of view of managing fisheries sensibly, coastal development, aquaculture development, and ultimately at the big scale, managing climate change. But yeah, I think we have to remain optimistic, and we have to keep sort of pushing the message that reefs are really important, that they're threatened. But there have been some really good examples of reefs that, you know, when they are well managed, they recover very well from disturbances.
That was James Guest from the Marine Biology Laboratory at the National University of Singapore, introducing us to the intricacies of coral reef mass spawning. And it's not actually just corals that take part in spawning like this. Lots of other marine animals do it as well, like the Palolo worms of the Pacific, which once a year break into two, releasing millions of wriggling tails packed with eggs and sperm into the water column. And the native people of Samoa scoop them up in nets and eat them, which I'm sure is considered quite the delicacy, but not sure if I'd like that on my plate on Valentine's Day. And Bermuda fireworms gather together and put on these eye-popping bioluminescent displays while they're courting each other and making babies. So it's all about sort of these massive love-ins. A lot of species end up doing that. If you'd like to hear a longer version of our interview with James, check out thenakedscientist.com/specials.
Are there really plenty more fish in the sea? Find out with Naked Oceans on the web at nakedscientist.com/oceans.